Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Writers Aloud. This week we're presenting the first in a three-part conversation between novelist Emma Darwin and radio writer Annie Caulfield, who are each trying out the other's genre. In this episode, Emma gives Annie some sound advice about the joys and tribulations of writing a novel. I visited the two of them at Emma's house in London.
My name's Annie Caulfield, and for quite a lot of my writing life, I've been writing drama and jokes and a little bit of non-fiction, but I really feel like I sort of want to take on the big thing, which always feels like the big proper writing is going to be writing a novel. And so that's why I'm talking to my friend Emma Darwin about that.
And I'm Emma Darwin, and I write novels, and I'm very hardwired for writing novels. I do write a bit of short fiction, and I found that after years and years of writing novels, first unpublished and then published, the frustration of writing novels is that they take so long. And while you're immersed in a novel, you've got lots of stuff that you can't work out in any other way because it doesn't belong in the novel. So I like writing short stories, and I had a sort of epiphany when I realised that a sort of 45-minute radio play is about the amount of material that I would use in a short story. And I love radio. I've always loved radio. And so I want to learn to write it. And it's interestingly different. And I find I come up against all sorts of basic questions that I don't know how to answer. So we thought we would discuss that.
Yes. I have started writing a novel. It's already run away from me. Run away from me a lot. Because in a play, you can have a sort of overview in drama. You can cut away to show that, you know, the bad guys are coming for the lead woman. Mm. And the lead woman, you know it's her story, but you can see the whole world around her. In this novel, I've already got the lead woman's point of view, and her neighbour's point of view, and her sister's point of view, and her mother's point of view, and her father's point of view, and it's just escalating. And I thought, well, maybe that's very clever. Maybe that's a sort of, you know, I'm writing something interesting and experimental, and there's all these fragmented points of view on this, but I don't think it is. I think it has got away from me.
The completely blank canvas of a novel, you know, you don't have to worry about anything about time or space or anything because it's just black marks on a page. And it's the blankest of blank canvases. You don't have to worry about how many actors you're employing. You don't have to worry about studio time or the length of the slot. It is alarmingly open and free. And I think you're right that your instinct that that's too many points of view is probably a good one, because it is hard to control a lot of points of view. Essentially, any point of view that we're in a novel, you're asking the reader to be involved with that character, and at least temporarily to have a sense of them and to be involved with what happens to them. And the more different characters you expect us to do that with, the more we're not likely to be deeply involved with anyone. And the thing that keeps a reader reading is being deeply involved with a small number of characters whose fate they really, really care about. If you wanted a rule of thumb, I would say think hard before you had more than, I don't know, somewhere between 3 and 6 viewpoint characters. The other thing to think about is, first of all, to always, in any scene, any chapter, whatever, to think really hard about which points of views are the ones that matter. It may only be one. You certainly don't want to be kind of zipping to and fro, because it sort of gives the reader the equivalent of jet lag. You may find that the characters you think are the important ones may not be, but it's part of the sort of first draft stuff. It's partly about who you want the reader to be involved with, but it's also about whose experience of a scene or half scene or whatever is the most compelling. I mean, for example, if you imagine a scene where Philip wants to propose to Anne, then it might well be that the first half, when he's psyching himself up to doing it and wondering whether she's going to say yes and what will happen when his mother finds out because she can't bear Anne, the obvious point of view to be in is his, because that's where the drama is. Come the proposal, it might well be that it's Anne's point of view after that that is the most fruitful, because she's suddenly in turmoil because she didn't think Philip was going to propose. In fact, she thought he was gay. So, I mean, that's a very crude example of where making the most of different points of view is about asking yourself which is most important for the reader's experience of the story. You need to be careful when you start thinking about using point of view purely for your purposes of what the reader needs to know or that sort of thing. I mean, obviously, which point of view you're in can be about that, but you should never just switch point of view because it's handy. There needs to be a dramatic reason in the formal sense of character in action, you know, and inside whose head is it most fruitful to be at the moment?
Yes, so I think that it's possibly that I'm not making enough decisions, that I'm what I've got, and I've thought about, oh, look, there's the uncle's point of view and the auntie's point of view and the neighbour's point of view, and perhaps we only need one of those and I have to work a bit harder to put anything that's useful in their point of view into somebody else's point of view. Do you know, I think, because I write radio drama, which is so constrained, I think I've been a bit like one of those dressage horses, like a circus pony that's had to walk very, very carefully. And I think I've been let out into a field. I think I've been let out to stud.
Yes.
But actually, I've been, I'm having to do show jumping.
Yes. Yes, and you are. Yes, it could be like show jumping. It's also more like cross country in a way. There's lots of different routes you could go through this wood. But the goal is to end up on the far side of the wood. And you could choose whether you go around this way, which is a bit more circuitous but more level, or this way, which is absolutely dead straight but over some quite difficult jumps or whatever. I think one of the things that's extremely helpful and is mostly just craft and technique is to learn ways to get the reader to know what someone's thinking when the point of view is not in their head. Learn to clue the reader in. For example, if we take our silly Philip and Anne example, you're in Philip's point of view. He's terribly worried about whether Anne's going to say yes or no and what his mother's going to think and whether, in fact, Anne is going to demand that they move to Glasgow when he likes living in Plymouth. And that's the obvious thing, is his feelings, his thoughts and his decisions about how to psych himself up and how to ask her and all the rest of it. But the reasonably awake reader can be clued into a lot about what Anne's thinking. By what she says, obviously, by what Philip notices of her body language, for instance. Now, he can notice things and understand them. He can think, oh God, she's got her arms folded across her front. She obviously doesn't want me to say this. One of the, you know, one of the ways in which fiction is not how people actually think, you know, you're not just reproducing how our minds actually work. It's about narrative technique. We can see her arms folded through his eyes, but he cannot understand the significance, but the reader may, you know, an experienced reader will read into the folded arms something maybe that Philip doesn't pick up. Just as if you've got a child narrator, they can record things and transmit things that they don't understand. That's where you can learn to express much more than you think you can from a particular point of view.
Without having to go into everybody else's
You don't
heads.
Have to hop over to Anne and say Anne wasn't at all sure she wanted Philip to ask her.
Yes, I think I've got a little bit overexcited about being inside people's heads because
you can't
certainly
do drama.
In a radio drama, well, you in radio you can because you can do internal voice, but you can't use it too much, and you probably wouldn't use it for more than two characters at most, and even then you're getting into quite an experimental area. So I think I got excited about being in people's heads, and actually it just becomes a sort of jumble. The skill is a little bit more like drama than I'd imagined, of having to use very little to show what the character whose head you aren't inside is thinking.
Yes, you don't need much. I mean, it's one of the things where you really are working with the experience of the reader. I mean, you know, if you handed a Martian a novel, he wouldn't spot the folded arms, spot the fact that the novelist has chosen to make us aware of them and think, oh, what's Annie thinking? Whether or not Philip is thinking, you know, what's Annie thinking? I don't mean you, I mean Anne.
No, he could think the folded arms are a negative thing. We could know the arms are folded because she's got frayed cuffs on her shirt.
Exactly. Well, maybe you might have, you probably wouldn't just whiz across to Anne's head and tell us about the frayed cuffs there and then, but you could have seeded them in the earlier scene.
We remember them.
If we were with Anne
earlier.
Before Philip arrived, as it were, we might well remember them. I mean, one of the most fascinating things, I think, with really understanding point of view is this business of when different people have completely different takes on the same thing. I mean, with my creative writing students, I would often get them to write that scene from all the way through from Philip's point of view and write that scene all the way through Anne's point of view. And then say, OK, we're in Philip's. How do we get the reader to understand what Anne's thinking? I think it helps hugely if you learn to think in terms of what John Gardner in The Art of Fiction calls psychic distance, which is this business of not just whose head are you in, that's pretty straightforward, but how far in are you? I mean, we can all say, Anne thought hard about Philip and remembered how kind he'd been when she fell in the river. Technically speaking, we are in Anne's thoughts. That's not something that drama can do. It is the thing that fiction does that almost no other art does. It's the exciting bit of fiction because it's the unique bit of fiction, if you like. To go what we would normally call deeper into Anne's head, what you're doing is you are getting us closer into Anne's consciousness, and there's basically sort of two elements to that. One is closer into her physical experience. So instead of saying Anne remembered how kind Philip was when she fell in the river, you would say Anne remembered the cold, smelly waters closing over her head and then Philip's hands suddenly grabbing her wrists and hauling her out and seeing his friendly face, you know, or something like that. Closer to her physical and emotional experience, but also closer to her voice. Because that's the other thing that's related to drama but is sort of unique to fiction, is the fact that characters' voices and the voice of the narrative are not the same thing, but they interpenetrate. So that as we get deeper into Anne's point of view, her voice, the way she thinks of things, will colour the prose more and more. For instance, if Philip rescued Anne from the water when she was little, it could be something like, Anne remembered how kind big cousin Philip was when she was little and she fell in the river, the water going over her head and her wanting mummy, and mummy wasn't there and nobody was there and she was all alone and the big sea monster was going to get her, and then these hands grabbed her wrists and started to haul her out. And it's still narrative, it's in free and direct style, which is where we stay in the narrative tense and in third person in this example, but it takes on the voice of the character. And that draws us closer into Anne's experience. Further and still would be something that was more like stream of consciousness, in that it would be so close to Anne's experience that it would be more of a jumble of sense data and thoughts and bits and pieces and so on. And then we're right deep in Anne, and that's the flexibility you've got in prose that you don't have in drama.
No, but you've still moved to Anne's point of view.
Well, all of those are in Anne's point of view, but how deep we are, the only real way I have of describing is how deep we are inside her.
Yes.
Is still, I mean, they're all technically in Anne's point of view. It's in Anne's point of view if you just inform us about something that Anne is thinking, technically speaking. Anne looked out of the window and saw a red car drawing up. Is technically in Anne's point of view. If Philip is the other side of the room and can't see out of the window, it can't be in his point
see,
of view.
See, this is where my head starts exploding.
Is it just practice?
And taking on a third person novel is quite a lot.
I think it is. I mean, so many people start with first person because it sorts out all those issues of point of view. All you have to think is, my character, can she see this? Does she think that? What does she see? What does she think? What does she feel? How does she put it? It also sorts out this question of voice, because you're locked into that character's character. And on the whole, the narrative comes out the way that she would think and say it. So first person is very easy from that point of view. It makes a lot of your decisions for you.
Yes.
Right at the beginning.
Yes.
It has its drawbacks.
Well, yes, because I'm used to writing, life writing really, travel writing, non-fiction, which is, so it's my voice.
Yes. Yes.
It's my voice. So I had thought it might be easier, instead of trying to leap straight into a new voice, to leap into other voices with a third person narrative. That's sort of what I've committed to. I think I'm going to have to learn to control myself a bit and pull them all in a bit, and also learn ways of doing things which are closer to drama, actually.
Yes.
Ways of doing things that don't involve immediately leaping like some sort of terrible parasite into somebody else's head, but find a way of showing.
I think that's a sort of basic skill. For example, I mean, if you imagine a play where you have one character who's in every scene, and there must be plenty of plays of which that's true. I mean, that's your kind of basic requirement for a novel in first person with what I call a character narrator, is that everything is transmitted through them, both in their voice. They say, I did this, I did that, I thought the other, and in how they perceive the world. You can only transmit characters to us how they see them, how your character sees them. It's an enormous constraint, which, as always with constraints in creative work, they are extremely fruitful. And it will push you to think, how on earth do I convey that my narrator, my character narrator, thinks that he's terribly arrogant and snotty, and actually he's very shy and nervous? I may not want the reader to know that. I may want the reader to go on thinking that Darcy is an arrogant git for a while. But equally, you may want to work with the gap between what your character narrator is perceiving and what the reader's perceiving.
This moves quite interestingly into my other problem, which I think may come from writing non-fiction in my own voice, which involves a lot of telling. I went to Cambodia, yes, and this and this and this, a lot of telling, and then a little bit of showing, and then I have to explain why things are like this in Cambodia, then a little bit more of an incident, which is completely not what you do in a novel, but I do find I'm starting to be a little bit bossy and directing the reader into what they should be thinking about this thing. With, you know, even not in my own voice, I'm getting the characters to be bossy.
Yes.
Any help I can have with showing and not telling would be very grateful. Yes.
Well, I mean, I think the really basic thing is, I think showing and telling are, they're shorthand that we all use. It's too late to change our minds about that terminology. I think it's enormously helpful instead to think of telling as informing, and to think of showing as evoking. And it's a spectrum. It is not an either or. And it is absolutely not true that you shouldn't tell. Telling is useful when we need information. It's useful for covering the ground when you need time to pass, for example. But it will not evoke the actual feel and smell and sniff and thought and emotion of a scene. That's the basic distinction. You need telling to cover the ground. September became October and still he didn't ring. That is telling, in a sense. You've decided you do not want to spend a chapter evoking the 6 weeks that he doesn't ring. There are things that make that a bit more vivid than it might have been. Time passed and he didn't get in touch is a bit blander. It's a bit more telly in the pejorative sense. September and October are concrete things. They have a feel. We know what they smell like. It's more vivid than 2 months.
Yes, yes.
And still he didn't ring also evokes something of what she's thinking. That's rather how she would say it to herself. So even though you haven't gone into ages of her sitting by the phone and weeping or whatever it would be, it's evoking a little bit of her. It's making it come alive in that sense.
So thinking quite hard about those linking telling pieces and making them more evocative is quite important. This is especially from writing drama. Describing is something I will either get, again, very carried away with. We've got every leaf on every tree and every dent in somebody's shoes that we may not need at all. Yes, but I feel that I've got to fill in the picture because there aren't all the other people. There are not even any sound men. There's nothing. Yes. It's just me. And so I'm overcompensating.
Yes, and I think sometimes you do have to, in the sense that it's what I call process writing, is that you are going to have to write that stuff to find out which is the detail that really works. I once wrote, I think he was going to propose to her, actually, and I wrote an entire bus journey for him, angsting about going to propose to her, looking out of the window, driving through London, which is one of my writing pleasures anyway, actually, is London. And anyway, we all like flexing our muscles and working our craft and just the sort of creative writing class pleasures of, you know, evoking something for ourselves. And I also hung a load of backstory on it, and it was really useful, and I conveyed lots of bits of past that I needed to convey, and I conveyed his character, and it was a really nice piece of writing. And in second draft, all it said was he caught a number 11 bus, walked up the steps and rang the doorbell.
Oh, isn't that interesting? Because I think there is, it is part of this, somebody's left the gate open and out I run, feeling absolutely. That I've got.
And
but it's still the same. I've got a limited amount of space, actually physically have a limited amount of space and time for a radio play.
Yeah.
But in a novel, well, there's a limited amount of you that people will tolerate.
Absolutely, yes. Well, and I think the thing is that in that instance, I decided that that was all we needed. Now, there are two things, though. Two reasons I'm glad I wrote the bit that got binned. A, it didn't get binned. I never throw away anything, really. It goes into a file called dump, because I pretend to myself that I'll go and find any good bits later, and 90% of the time I don't, but at least it reconciles me to murdering that particular darling. I think the other thing is, writing is partly how we work things out if we're writers. And so that was all good stuff to work out. That was stuff that I maybe needed to work out for myself. That was stuff that clued me into the atmosphere. For all I know, later in the story, some of that would have come somewhere else. So you just have to say, okay, that was process writing. That's okay. That's part of the process. The fact that it doesn't end up in the next draft is neither here nor there. It was not wasted.
Drama's much smaller, so you've got a much smaller dump file. But I think I've got a habit of knowing what's going to dump, but I know a lot of stuff before, and I do it before I commit to paper.
I think that's true.
So I think it's learning. So you can do the process quite quickly in your head if you're in the habit of writing drama. You probably need to write it all out in a novel because you've got a much bigger canvas.
Well, I think also when it's your first novel, I've got better with mine at having a sort of twitch of whether it's likely that this bus journey is going to be useful or not. But on the whole, certainly when I'm in what lots of people would call shitty first draft mode, and I often call crazy first draft mode, which is I'll do whatever, I'll follow my nose, I'll see where it goes. And if I really, really feel like this bus journey is a thing that I want to write as a part of the sort of developmental process, then I will. But yes, on the whole, it's just experience. You get to know quicker whether this thing that your imagination has thrown up as a possible thing to write is likely to be useful or not.
I partly have been led astray by when you read those interviews, when you read interviews with novelists, not you, who say, oh, I just let the characters take me where they will. And so I thought that would happen, but that they are taking me where they will. Yes. And I'm really lost now in a forest. So.
If you're really struggling to make a character do what you thought they should do, then I do think it's one's really hardwired sense of how people operate and how this imagined person operates. And you really should listen to it. But whether that means you follow the character, and in first draft, I tend to think that's sensible because your strong and intuitive sense is operating well, in which case it's probably operating right. Having said that, if it's really trying to push in a direction that isn't going to work for lots of other reasons, sometimes you have to go back earlier and say, okay, what have I made them like that they're wanting to do this? Should I remake them further back so that the path I want them to go on does intuitively work, does make coherent sense? I mean, it's kind of, if I were you, I wouldn't start from here.
Yes.
But certainly in crazy first draft mode, I would say, do listen to those voices, because they're probably right. You know, I know people who've ended up writing a novel of whom the main character was not the main character they thought they were working with.
You see, and the other thing is that I think all this is going to take an enormous amount of time.
Yes.
And so
they do.
Moving on from the horse thing, an analogy, I now think that I'm somebody who's been playing cricket... part of a team, a slow game where you don't need an awful lot of stamina. Now I'm going to have to play championship tennis on my own, running about for a very long time. Because even travel writing, you're not making stuff up. Life is a part of your team. It's doing stuff for you.
Yes.
Suddenly, where do you get the stamina? Because this could go on for years, couldn't it, this travel writing?
Yes, they do that.
So how do you not lose heart?
Well, I do lose heart frequently. It's what God invented chocolate for. I managed not to lose heart partly by having a plan. Now, I know the word plan brings a lot of writers out in bumps, and I do not mean a detailed route map from London to Manchester with every turning and every tree marked out, and it's a disaster if I go off it. What I much more mean is a plan where I get in the car in the morning and I think I'm driving to Manchester. I know that I will be turning left past the house and right at the lights. And I've decided I'm going to go by Blackfriars Bridge and King's Cross. But then I'm going to take the M40, not the M1. And I'm going to end up at Manchester. But whether I go left or right by Bolton, my English geography is not all it might be, I don't know now. When I stop for coffee, I'll have a look at the next bit of the map. I basically plan a bit ahead of myself. But in the far distance is Manchester. And so I see myself getting a bit closer. Word count's enormously important. The friend who taught me to knit when I was a student said, and we'll get you a pattern for a stripy sweater, because it will take you forever to knit this sweater, but at least you can quite often say you finished a stripe. And it's so true. So I think word counts are enormously important. In a 4-hour writing stint on a first draft, I will write 2,600 words. That is entirely because that's 20 pages of my big scruffy notebook in my big handwriting, every other line, every other page. And some days that will not happen. If the builders are outside, then it may not happen. The real demand is that I have my bum on that chair for 4 hours. If I have my bum on that chair for 4 hours and I'm doing nothing but writing and the words don't come, then that is just because they weren't going to. But the weird thing is they always do. If they don't, it's usually because I don't enough know where I'm going. And then I will stop trying to produce more words and I'll think, OK, where is this scene going? What do I want to happen in this scene? So word counts are very useful. I think plans are useful because you're not at sea. You can always write the next bit. It may not be terribly good. On the whole, I'm a kind of shitty first draft merchant. I know lots of writers who aren't, who need to feel that each bit is more or less solid under their feet before they can do the next bit. But I do think for the scale of a novel, it's enormously helpful to try and work fairly fast, because the faster you work, the closer you are approximating to the reader's experience of the novel. If you can manage to write a 3,000-word scene in a couple of mornings, however rough it is, however much you're telling yourself the words are just the placeholders for the perfect words when you know what they are, if you can do that in a couple of sessions, then you will have a sense of how that scene, you know, the pace and rhythm of it, which dramatists you know, yes, you know loads about. If you can manage to do that fairly fast and be heading for that point where whatever happens you've decided happens, then that's a chunk of your story.
Yes, no, that's very useful, because I do, in drama, get to the end just to see the shape and some rough, yes, sort of indentations, yes, of the inner shape and, yes, the, and as you say, yes, the rhythm of it, what, yes, what's going to be a crowd scene, yes, what's going to be, yes, a quiet scene. So that, yes, that makes me feel a lot less daunted, actually, yes, that I just think bash through to the end the way you would with the play.
Bash through to the end.
Not going to be done in a week, but imagine, yeah, but it's the exactly, yeah, the same process, yes, only more chocolate and a lot longer.
Yes. I think you've got an enormous advantage as a dramatist in a way, because you're used to thinking in terms of scenes. I mean, we have the fluidity in fiction that you can move in and out of narrative that isn't a scene with characters in action having dialogue with each other. You know, you can slide in and out of that. I mean, quite often I will start with a scene but do what you can't really do in drama, which is simply to brush over the bit of a scene that isn't particularly useful or just to condense it. Philip will arrive and she will say, would you like some coffee? And then actually in real life there's quite a lot of faffing around with coffee and that sort of stuff. Now that might be completely unimportant, in which case you might just say, when they'd sorted out coffee, he said, oh, I see you've moved that picture to the other wall, say, and then we'll be into the thing that she says, yes, it was somebody gave it to me, and he starts wondering whether who the somebody was and whether it's important. But equally, say years later when they broke up, he comes back and she says, would you like some coffee? And he says, actually, no, I've given up caffeine. Have you got any peppermint tea? And she thinks, who's taught him to like peppermint tea?
Aha.
Exactly. So the coffee moment might be really, really important, or it might not be. And what you can do in prose fiction is it's infinitely expandable and contractible, how long you take to do anything.
You see, that, you know,
you,
yes,
can cover a year in a sentence.
You could.
You can cover, you know, if you're doing really hard action scenes, you can take longer to evoke the thing than the bomb going off could possibly have taken in real life. You've got that infinite expandability and contractibility. Just as you can go infinitely far into a head and infinitely far out, you can say, in the far off days of Uther Pendragon, witches stalked the earth. You know, that's very telly-tell, if we go back to the showing and telling terminology. You know, it's a good example, actually, of telling that's extremely evocative while not being deep inside anybody's head. You know, you could cover the whole of the world of your story in a sentence like that. You could cover a century in a sentence. But equally, you could get right down into a particular witch casting a spell and spend two pages on it.
That is an interesting thing, that you have the advantage of time movement. You can use narrator in drama.
Yes, you can.
But that is always sort of cheating. It,
yes,
is always really,
yes,
cheating.
Yes.
And otherwise, you have to cut, and you have to be quite sharp about where to cut, that you would cut to after the coffee.
Yes, yes, yes.
Because it wasn't really important.
Yes,
it's just why,
sure,
they,
yeah,
gathered, yeah, in that point.
Some clinking mugs, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a new thing, to have to write these in between,
yes,
bits,
yes,
that get you from scene to scene, because I feel sort of, well, I want to go to there now.
Yes, yes.
But I have to remember, yes, that I can't just cut. I have,
well,
to take,
well, you can.
Them.
I mean, you can just do a jump cut. There's no reason you shouldn't. You will then have to make sure you anchor the reader very fast.
Yes.
So in some ways it feels like the easy option just to cut straight to when he rang the doorbell. But I think actually it's really important, if you want to have the full toolkit at your command, to learn to expand and contract.
Yes,
you know,
and it's all the rhythm as well.
Even
in drama, if you're doing a lot of fast cutting, you,
yes,
have to take a slow scene. I think earlier, yeah, you said to me about you have to have the scene where James Bond gets out of the water and,
yes,
sits on the beach for a while.
Yeah, catches his breath, works things out, but it's for James Bond, but it's also for the reader.
Yeah, you have to have a little bit of breath,
yes,
and the mood is changing,
yes,
now. Something is going to happen,
yes,
that's slightly different.
And those linky, and that's what you don't necessarily get with a jump cut, that you would if you develop your skills in linking real time, either before the scene, you know, September moved into October and still he didn't ring, or within the scene, if the really important bits of the scene are the beginning when they first re-encounter one another after 10 years. And then there's a kind of fairly ordinary bit of coffee, or there's a bit where they would have been telling each other their news about what they've done in the last 10 years, which we already know because we've had it earlier in the book. You might well cover that, you know. So she told him about Venice and he told her about the Arctic. And obviously it might be that those conversations are fraught with significance, in which case you might open it out and give it to us more like real time, though you do then have to be careful not to just repeat all the stuff about the Arctic that we had three chapters ago. But you can still compress it and then say, and then he took a deep breath and said, you know, I've never forgotten you, don't you? Or whatever. And we're into where this scene is going for your novelistic storytelling purposes. And off they go and she says, no, really, and goes all wobbly or whatever it is.
Yes, yes. Oh, that's great. So you have the narrative, instead of having to write a mood-changing scene, you can do a couple of sentences of narrative to move
and,
you along.
And as we were saying, you know, it, just because it's a couple of sentences in narrative doesn't mean that it can't do what I call a making your
which
telling
is
showy.
The earth.
Yeah, which is stalk the earth. Or, you know, September became October and still he didn't ring the bastard. We're there. It's taken up no more space.
Yeah.
So that's kind of another really useful tool in your toolkit, is to learn to make narrative vivid. A quick ground-covering narrative.
Yes, and not feel I have to write the whole 2 months.
Yeah. You may have to write the whole 2 months, particularly when you haven't written fiction before or not much, to find out how to do that.
Yeah.
Some people do it by instinct, because anyone who's got any talent does some things by instinct and has to learn other things formally. But I think it's a fantastically useful thing to learn.
Okay, well, this is good. I feel quite excited now. I feel as though I've got some control. By tomorrow, I probably everything will have run off into the forest again, but I feel quite excited for now.
That was Emma Darwin and Annie Caulfield. You can read more about Emma on her website at www.emmadarwin.com and about Annie on her website at www.annie-caulfield.com. That's Caulfield spelled C-A-U-L. And that concludes episode 3, which was recorded and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 4, Kate Cahoon explores some of the responsibilities of non-fiction writers, and Katie Grant considers the writer's duty towards the dead. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.